he stated with finality. The choice of Cortelyou is irrevocable. Delegates were left with no alternative but to ratify Roosevelt's selection. Roosevelt was less successful in dictating the Republican Party platform. While it largely mirrored the president's public actions and statements on foreign policy, the Panama Canal, trusts, and labor, observers noted it reflected a difference of opinion on the tariff. While Roosevelt argued that failure to revise the tariff would put a formidable weapon in the hands of our opponents, the platform espoused the principle of protectionism as a cardinal policy of the Republican Party. As Roosevelt predicted, the Democrats seized on the issue to proclaim that a Republican victory would herald 4 years more of trust domination, of high prices to the consumer and of low prices to the producer. Nevertheless, Roosevelt hesitated to push the issue, fearful that a tariff battle would pit Westerners anxious for relief against the Eastern industrial and financial establishment, thereby creating a disastrous schism in the party. Nor did Roosevelt contest the selection of Indiana Senator Charles Fairbanks as vice president. While he far preferred Illinois Congressman Robert Hitt, of all men the pleasantest to work with, he accepted the cautious, slow, conservative Fairbanks as a concession to the old guard. Since his own experience as vice president had convinced him that the office was essentially powerless, there was no need to take a stand. Paramount was winning his party's presidential nomination. Seated with his family on the south veranda of the White House, Roosevelt received news of his unanimous nomination. They had just finished lunch when Secretary Loeb brought the anticipated telegram. After affectionate congratulations from his wife and children, Roosevelt returned to his office, where members of the press, many of whom he considered his personal friends, had convened. The president was in exceptionally good humor as he handed out cigars, joking that the stern prohibitionist Carrie Nation would not approve. The AP reporter described the scene. With genial raillery, he chatted with one, exchanged comments on men or things with another, laughed heartily at a cartoon of himself to which his attention was drawn, sketched in a freehand way the incidents of the convention, recalled some interesting situations, personal and political, and in conclusion again thanked his friends for expressions of their congratulations. When the Democrats assembled in St. Louis 2 weeks later, the party's conservative wing had clearly regained control. Though William Jennings Bryan remained the heartfelt choice of the rank and file, the professional politicians were starved for victory. After two consecutive defeats with Bryan, party leaders turned to a gold Democrat, Judge Alton B. Parker. Bryan's repeated calls for using silver rather than gold, as the standard unit of currency value, had pleased Western debtors who would benefit from inflation, but had angered Eastern creditors whose money would be devalued. Democratic bosses hoped Parker could both retain Bryan's liberal base in the West and win back Eastern conservatives who had broken with the party on the gold issue. Covering the Democratic convention for Collier's, William Allen White portrayed Bryan as the hero of the occasion, even though he did not triumph. Though deafening yells and epileptic spasms greeted Bryan's every appearance, the delegates had vowed not to let sentiment rule a third time. They were like men who had been stark mad, observed White, and the fear of it coming back was in their hearts. Bryan managed to keep the platform from endorsing gold, but the overwhelming vote for Parker's nomination signaled that his 8-year reign was over. The platform roundly denounced trusts and protectionism as robbery of the many to enrich the few, demanded large reductions in public spending, decried executive usurpation of legislative functions, called for Philippine independence, and advocated direct election of United States senators. The nomination voting was completed shortly before midnight on Friday, July 8th. The reporters gathered in Parker's hometown of Esopus, New York, were disappointed to learn that the judge had retired with orders that he not be awakened. As a result, the nominee was not apprised of his victory until returning from his regular morning swim in the Hudson River. Asked for a statement, Parker replied that he would wait until he received official notification. The delay provided time for a shrewd strategic maneuver. At noon, he dictated a telegram to be read before the convention adjourned, informing delegates that he regarded the gold standard as firmly and irrevocably established. If his views on this issue proved to be unsatisfactory to the majority, he should feel it his duty to decline the nomination. The convention moved swiftly to adopt a resolution stating that a currency question did not appear on the platform simply because it was no longer an issue at this time. The gold standard would not be challenged, they assured Parker, leaving nothing to prevent him from accepting the nomination. Parker's move was most adroit, Roosevelt acknowledged. He is entitled to hearty praise from the standpoint of a clever politician, the president observed, adding that the maneuver gained for Parker all of Cleveland's strength without any of Cleveland's weakness, and made him, on the whole, the most formidable man the Democrats could have nominated. William Taft disagreed, predicting that the success of Parker's machination would be short-lived, unlike the rift within the party it had perpetuated. He assured Roosevelt that Parker was stronger the morning the telegram was published than he ever will be again. Nevertheless, Roosevelt fretted that he now faced a hard and uphill fight in the general election. According to his habit, Theodore Roosevelt sought to harness anxiety through action. He had begun crafting his acceptance speech immediately after his nomination, but now he turned to it with a vengeance, determined to sharpen its tone. "I always like to do my fighting in the adversary's corner," he told Lodge. The speech, delivered on July 27th from the sun-splashed veranda at Sagamore Hill, was received with immense enthusiasm by the assembled crowd. "It is just such a statement as we should expect Theodore Roosevelt to make," the Minneapolis Journal editorialized. "Terse, luminous, logical, convincing." His defense of Republican policy was characteristically forceful, and his satirical commentary on the Democratic Party, keen and polished as a Japanese sword blade. Parker's acceptance speech had no such luster. Between bouts of heavy rain, the Democratic candidate held forth for 40 minutes from the soaked lawn of his Esopus country home. Parker's flat style and lack of oratorical experience was immediately apparent. He used few gestures, failed to distinguish his positions from Roosevelt's, and mustered no bugle call. The most vigorous applause reportedly followed his closing declaration that, if elected, he would not run for a second term. Roosevelt was relieved that his rival's shifty and tricky gambit had failed to straddle the factions within the Democratic Party. Perhaps, Roosevelt told Lodge, Taft's assessment had been correct from the start. Characteristically, Roosevelt began drafting his formal letter of acceptance weeks before its early September publication date, ensuring ample time for consultation with his advisors. Taft attended numerous breakfasts, lunches, and midnight discussions to dissect each section. "His opponents may attack the letter," Taft told Nellie, "but they will not say it is lacking in snap or ginger." Seeking a broad sounding board, Roosevelt also circulated drafts to Root, Lodge, Knox, Hay, Garfield, and civil service reformer Lucius Swift, requesting merciless critiques. "I went at the letter hammer and tongs," Swift told his wife, "and got in a good many points." Published on September 12th, Roosevelt's letter received widespread praise. "Remarkable," the New York Times declared, "astonishingly able." The Washington Post observed that he had constructed a veritable keynote for the stump, in which signal Republican objectives were championed with enough spirit to arouse the partisan masses. The letter's strength, Taft told Roosevelt, was the challenge contained in every line of it to the Democrats to be specific in their charges and to deal with facts. He maintained that if Parker produced a letter of acceptance akin to his tepid speech, it would be glaringly apparent just how little real ammunition the Democrats have. The lackluster piece Taft anticipated from the Democratic candidate did not materialize. Parker's 6,000-word letter presented a spirited attack against centralized government at home and imperialism abroad, along with a robust call for tariff reform and further trust regulation. Republicans frankly acknowledged that now, the issues of the campaign would be more squarely joined. The Times deemed Parker's letter a great paper. Though not designed to stir the yells of crowds, it would appeal to men who think, presenting a first-rate test of the people. Roosevelt conceded that Parker had cleverly managed to engage disparate factions of his party, giving heart to his supporters and halting the downward movement of his campaign. At such moments, Roosevelt sorely longed to take the offensive in person and face his Democratic challenger on the stump. "I could cut him to ribbons if I could get at him in the open," he wrote to Kermit. But, of course, a president can't go on the stump and can't indulge in personalities. His only option was to sit still and trust that his cabinet officials, traversing the country on his behalf, could make the case for his election. Given William Howard Taft's marked aversion for preparing and delivering public speeches, he surprised even himself by emerging as the most sought-after speaker on the campaign trail. "It seems strange that with an effort to keep out of politics and with my real dislike for it, I should thus be pitched into the middle of it," he told his close friend Howard Hollister. Yet in letters to Nellie, he confided his irritation at the extent to which mere political discussion dominated cabinet meetings. "I suppose it is natural," he lamented, "but it seems to me to be undignified." Nevertheless, as the campaign heated up, he settled into his role as spokesman for the administration. "I rather think that I am to do more work than any other member of the cabinet," he noted with pride, "but I don't object to that." Regardless of his engagement, Taft struggled with his inveterate tendency to procrastinate. Preparing for his first major speech during Harvard's commencement, where he and former Democratic Secretary of State Richard Olney would square off on the Philippine issue, he confessed to his brother that he was right down to almost the last day in the preparation, as is usual with me. The night before departing for Cambridge, he reviewed the speech with the president and James Garfield. The president anticipated the address would stand as a great public document. Garfield likewise rated it a masterly argument, recording in his diary that he considered Taft a truly great man. William Taft presented his speech to the Harvard Law School alumni at Sanders Theater, presided over by Chief Justice Melville Fuller and Harvard President Charles W. Eliot. For 2 hours in the morning, Taft simply but clearly recounted the history of America's relationship with the Philippines, beginning with the war against Spain and the decision to exert sovereignty over the islands. He argued that American policy promoted the Philippines for the Filipinos and would eventually prepare the people to govern themselves. To promise independence before educating the populace, as so many Democrats and independents urged, Taft believed would be a mistake. Olney's rebuttal openly acknowledged that Taft had rightly earned the general admiration of the islanders by the justice and skillfulness of his rule, and by the tact, patience, and humanity of his dealings with the Filipino people. He insisted, however, that the United States must not sacrifice American lives and American treasures indefinitely and without stint for the education and elevation of the Filipinos. The Constitution did not authorize the government to turn itself into a missionary to the benighted tribes, or to tax the toiling masses of this country for the benefit of motley groups of the brown people of the tropics. Simply, continued occupation of the Philippines represented a departure from the traditions and interests of the United States. Despite their opposing views, both speakers remained impeccably civil. Their differences, the Cincinnati Enquirer observed, were, of course, stated in terms that prevented any exhibition of acrimony. When such men as Taft and Olney meet, the public can expect enlightenment on high ground. Olney's presentation was a good thing, the Enquirer added, for it allowed the young men of Harvard to have an opportunity to hear both sides of the question. Otherwise, Secretary Taft might have hypnotized them, for they love him. Taft was emboldened when his first campaign appearance generated nothing but positive notices. "I fired my gun at Cambridge and was pleasantly disappointed to find how well received it was," he drolly wrote to Roosevelt. Will, Nellie, and the children soon departed Cambridge for their summer home on Murray Bay. Having spent the previous two summers in the Philippines, Taft was overjoyed at their return to this magical place, where his brothers and their families could readily gather for picnics, trout fishing, and daily rounds of golf. "The air is bracing and delightful," Taft wrote to Roosevelt at Oyster Bay. "I feel a boyish feeling. I'd like to jump up and down and shout." Though Nellie and the children planned to remain in Murray Bay until late September, campaign and cabinet duties required Will's return to Washington at the end of July. In August, Taft delivered two more impressive speeches on the Philippines, one in St. Louis and the other at Chautauqua. Increasingly confident in his area of expertise, Taft nevertheless remained anxious about a campaign appearance in Montpelier, Vermont, at the end of August. "The next 10 days I must devote myself to the preparation," he told his wife. For better than 20 years, Taft had not given a purely political speech, and feared he was a bit rusty on general politics. Indeed, he mused, "the bench disqualifies one in this respect." Roosevelt was particularly eager for Taft to speak in Vermont, where the September state elections were considered an important indicator of the vote in the presidential contest. Though the Green Mountain State generally leaned Republican, the size of her majority was thought to portend the trend of public opinion. Rather than presenting an overview of Republican policies, Taft chose to focus on Roosevelt's leadership, mounting a spirited defense against repeated charges that the president was a bully, whose dictatorial demeanor toward Congress transgressed the constitutional separation between executive and legislative powers. When Theodore Roosevelt is attacked for being a strong-headed tyrant, obstinate in his pride of opinion and failure to listen to argument, "I am in a position to know," he reassured his audience of more than 1,500 Vermonters. "In all my experience, I never have met a man in authority with less pride of opinion," he asserted. "I have never met a man who was so amenable to reason, so anxious to reach a just conclusion, and so willing to sacrifice a previously formed opinion." Rather than a litany of cliched tributes, Taft's vivid, personal testimony concerning the president's nature and character won the interest and enthusiasm of his listeners. "It was a success," he told Nellie, proudly relaying that he was told by many that it was thought to be the best political speech delivered in Vermont. The press concurred. "It would be difficult to praise it too highly," a Pennsylvania paper editorialized. "Judge Taft had already attained a high reputation as a jurist and executive officer. Now he had established himself as a political orator of the first rank. Probably no member of the president's cabinet will prove more effective in defense and support of his administration." Published in its entirety in the Boston Transcript, Taft's speech promised to become a textbook for Republican orators and writers. Most importantly, the Vermont vote proved a glorious triumph for Republicans, with a larger margin than anyone had predicted. "I am pleased as punch about Vermont," Roosevelt exclaimed to Taft, adding that the unforeseen magnitude should cut off some of the money supply of our adversaries. Taft next proceeded to Portland, Maine. Roosevelt had received a rather gloomy letter from Senator Eugene Hale about Republican prospects in the state and hoped that Taft's presence would help energize support. Buoyed by positive reactions, Taft prepared himself to speak without notes for the first time. Despite initial anxiety that his memory might fail and leave him floundering, his performance went smoothly. Taft continued north to Murray Bay for a final 2-week vacation before the true rigors of the campaign began. To his great surprise, a large contingent of Murray Bay residents appeared at his house on the night of his 47th birthday. A torchlight parade escorted him to the bay's largest house, where they feasted and drank, danced the Virginia reel, sang songs, presented gifts, and proposed toasts. Taft wrote to Roosevelt every other day during his vacation, planning future speeches, exchanging political gossip, discussing Parker's campaign. "Mrs. Taft says that you must be bored by the number of letters that I write you," he jested. "Now that I have my secretary with me, you may expect more." Ease and camaraderie mark their correspondence from this period, as they discussed matters both personal and political. Roosevelt complained freely about their mutual friend Maria Storer. Taft described a new diet, requiring him to refrain from drinking all liquids with his meals. Roosevelt cursed the infernal liars in the Independent Press, the New York Times, Evening Post, Herald, with their outrageous claims that he had sent a corruption fund to influence the vote in Vermont. Taft recounted playing golf every day in air that is as invigorating as dry champagne, without any evil after effect. Upon his return to Washington in late September, Taft was immediately dispatched to Ohio, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey. "Do not, in any speech, take any position seeming in the least to be on the defensive," Roosevelt cautioned. "Attack Parker. Show that his proposals are insincere, his statements lacking in candor and disingenuous. Announce that we have not the slightest apology to make, that we intend to continue precisely as we have been doing in the past, that we shall not abandon building up the Navy and keeping up the Army, or abandon rural free delivery, or irrigation of the public lands. Either Parker is insincere, or else he must propose to abandon these works and other works like them in order to economize." On October 1st, Taft opened the Republicans' Ohio campaign with a day-long extravaganza in Warren's public square that featured marching bands, songs, and large delegations from neighboring Cleveland, Youngstown, and Akron. With nearly 2,000 people in attendance, the campaign kickoff was considered the most auspicious in years. Sharing the platform with the state's governor and two United States senators, Taft delivered the keynote address. Following Roosevelt's directives, he targeted Parker directly, saving his most stinging condemnation for the gross distortions and outright lies the Democratic candidate had spread about the administration's expenditures in the Philippines. After reading the statements of Judge Parker concerning the Philippines, Taft repeatedly avowed, "I sometimes wonder whether I was ever there." While Taft would have welcomed Nellie's company on the campaign trail, she had to settle the family into their new house at 1904 K Street in Washington and prepare the children for school. In daily letters, she related her progress in unpacking cartons of furniture, carpeting floors, setting up beds, working with carpenters, and arranging books in the library. With Robert attending Horace's boarding school in Watertown, Connecticut, only the two younger children remained at home. 13-year-old Helen joined Ethel Roosevelt at the National Cathedral School. 7-year-old Charlie was enrolled in the local public school, where he became great friends with Quentin Roosevelt. "I hope Charlie's first day in school was a success," Taft wrote from Indiana. "I can remember mine. It was not." As the campaign ground on, Taft's yearning to be home with his wife and children intensified. "I wish I could get on the train and go right to you now," he told Nellie. With each passing day, he grew wearier of presenting the same speech. In Indianapolis, the crowd grew restless, some departing early as he held forth for nearly 2 hours. "I don't think my style of speaking is calculated to hold the curious," he admitted to Nellie. But the audience which remained was most attentive. She could not but smile when he mentioned the length of the speech. "If you confine it to an hour," she suggested, "I think people will stay." A tense situation developed in mid-October when a delegation of cigar and tobacco manufacturers, irate at Taft's proposed reduction of the tariff on Philippine tobacco, threatened to control cigar makers enough to defeat Roosevelt in New York, Connecticut, Missouri, and almost everywhere else. Enlisting the support of labor organizations in the cigar trade, they petitioned Congress and approached the president just at the anxious time when everything assumes distorted proportions. That same day, Taft wrote the president, "I feel sure you would not wish me to retract anything on that subject," he began, adding that he would willingly cancel appearances in affected states that might emphasize the issue. If the president felt it necessary, Taft concluded, he would retire from the cabinet rather than back down on the principle. "Fiddle-dee-dee," Roosevelt responded, quickly dismissing Taft's resignation talk as nerves or something. While there was certainly no sense in exacerbating the issue by dwelling on the tobacco tariff, the New England states were precisely where his talent was most necessary. With this reassurance, Taft continued his grueling schedule, but grumbled to his brother that the issue confirmed his resolve that he would not run for president if you guaranteed the office. It is awful to be afraid of one's shadow. As summer advanced into fall, the struggles between labor and capital increasingly defined the campaign. Democrats sought to contrast Roosevelt, a man who never needed to do a day's work, and Parker, a man who had always had to work to maintain himself and his family. This emblematic opposition sought to distinguish the party of aristocracy and oligarchy from the party of liberty and equality. Democratic newspapers predicted that the rank and file of labor would vote in record numbers against Roosevelt. It is the culmination of many grievances which union labor has against the party and its leaders, adjudged one paper. In Pennsylvania, Old Guard Republican Senator Boies Penrose had utterly ignored union demands relating to construction of the state's new capital. In the Rocky Mountain states, the bitterness of union miners against conservative Governor Peabody threatened to supply Parker with such overwhelming labor support that Republicans were reportedly conceding the region to Democrats. The rising cost of living fueled these complaints of the working class, undercutting Republican campaign strategies of a full dinner pail that had once helped McKinley. All the while, Roosevelt was hammered by party conservatives for being too friendly with labor. Day after day, the Sun savaged him for his actions in the coal strike, his temerity in inviting labormen to dinner at the White House, and his honorary membership in the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. "He is on the side of the men who are every day seeking to overthrow the Constitution," the Sun stridently charged. "He has joined their organizations, espoused their creed, received their leaders at his dwelling and in his official residence, and as President of the United States has welcomed their delegates." Simultaneously, Roosevelt lamented that populist publications reviled him for breaking bread with the great corporate heads. As this antagonism intensified, Ray Baker began drafting a piece for McClure's to dissect each candidate's point of view on the labor issue. He read every one of Judge Parker's decisions addressing unions and corporations, discovering that, without exception, they were strongly favorable to the contentions of labor. In one case, Parker had declared that the state has a right to limit the hours of employment for bakers to 60 a week. In another instance, he stated that cities must pay the prevailing rate of wages. In still another, he ruled in favor of the closed shop. Baker expected a discussion of labor issues when he was invited to spend the afternoon with the judge at Esopus. "Personally, he is a most attractive man, a good type of the comfortable country gentleman," Baker told his father. "I was disappointed in finding him so apparently uninformed on labor affairs, though, of course, his mode of life has given him little opportunity of coming into contact with the great vital forces of the industrial conflict." Indeed, beyond his judicial decisions, Baker was unable to decipher coherent underlying principles governing Parker's approach to the paramount issue of the day. In contrast, when Baker requested from Roosevelt a clarification of what many considered a contradictory position on the labor issue, Roosevelt promptly produced a nearly 2,000-word reply. "I cannot help feeling," Roosevelt testily responded, "that the people who have been confused by my action in the various labor cases must be of such limited brain power that nothing in the world will make my position clear to them." To comprehend his stance, he insisted, one need only study his words and actions over time. "If such creatures remain confused," he continued, "I hardly think it will be possible to set them right. For there must be people who do not understand that when I say I wish to give a square deal to every man, I mean just exactly that, and that I intend to stand by the capitalist when he is right, and by the laboring man when he is right, and will oppose the one, if he goes wrong, just as fearlessly as I should oppose the other." Those offended by his dinner invitations to labor leaders should understand that the White House door would always swing open for labor leaders just as easily as for the big capitalists, but no easier. In this striking letter, Roosevelt proceeded to articulate his actions in the coal strike, the 8-hour day, the Colorado situation, immigration law, and convict labor. The basic principle and convictions Roosevelt so aggressively outlined spurred Baker to reread carefully all of Roosevelt's speeches and writings on the subject of labor. "I am perfectly astonished," he wrote to Roosevelt, "though I thought myself pretty well informed before, at the number and definiteness and breadth of your declarations on the labor question, as well as the record of your acts since your early days in the legislature. And if I, who represent perhaps the average busy American, am astonished, I believe a great many other people will be." Several weeks prior to the election, Baker's article entitled "Parker and Roosevelt on Labor, Real Views of the Two Candidates on the Most Vital National Problem," appeared in McClure's. Without any direct exposition or elaboration from Parker, Baker had relied on the judge's reasoning in the applicable half-dozen cases he had presided over. On the other hand, with access to a lifetime of Roosevelt's statements and decisions, Baker could present a clear idea of the labor platform upon which he stands. Beginning with Roosevelt's early success as a state legislator against sweatshop conditions in tenement cigar factories, Baker demonstrated that, unlike old guard Republicans, the president was a thoroughgoing believer in labor organization. In contrast to radical Democrats, however, Roosevelt recognized that there is no worse enemy of the wage worker than the man who condones mob violence in any shape or who preaches class hatred. The time and attention Roosevelt had devoted to the journalist's request proved most rewarding. The L.A. Times observed that Baker's thorough and painstaking methods provided McClure's vast middle-class audience with a clear, illuminating portrait of the president's fair-minded and long-standing attitudes toward labor. With only weeks remaining until the election, Roosevelt recognized that while the bulk of the voters would oppose or support him based on his 3 years in office, a sufficient mass of voters remained who might yet be swayed by a dramatic turn in the campaign. Mid-October delivered just such a development, when the discovery of immense corporate contributions to the Republican Party suddenly threatened to compromise Roosevelt's hopes for victory. "The steady advance in the influence of money in our public life," decried a New York Times editorial, "works as a poison on the minds and hearts of men." Such toxicity was abundantly clear, the Times added, when a man of Mr. Roosevelt's native scorn for corruption can be the willing, the eager beneficiary of funds paid into his campaign chest through his former secretary and former cabinet officer, Mr. Cortelyou, with the undisguised hope that it will be repaid in favors to the subscribers. Lincoln Steffens called on Roosevelt at the White House to suggest that the issue could be lanced if he were to return all corporate contributions and look instead to small donations from the general public to fund his campaign. An informed public of small contributors would make the millions feel that it was their government as it is, and that you and your administration were beholden to the many, not to the few. Such a change, Steffens believed, would herald a new era in election politics. "If we must have campaign contributions, this is the way to raise them," he concluded. "If you would start this method now, you really would begin a tremendous reform." Roosevelt most emphatically rejected the premise of Steffens' argument, insisting that he already felt beholden to the many more than to the few. Whether an individual or corporation contributed $1 or $100,000 would never sway him to sponsor legislation or take executive action. It was entirely legitimate to accept contributions, no matter how large, he contended, so long as they were given and received with no thought of any more obligation on the part of the National Committee or of the National Administration than is implied in the statement that every man shall receive a square deal. In the end, Roosevelt willingly received hundreds of thousands of dollars from executives in dozens of corporations, including J.P. Morgan's banking house, New York Central Railroad, Standard Oil, General Electric, and International Harvester. Only when apprised of a check for $100,000 from the Standard Oil Company, the mother of trusts, did Roosevelt draw the line. He instructed Cortelyou to return the money immediately. In view of the open and pronounced opposition of the Standard Oil Company to the establishment of the Bureau of Corporations, one of the most important accomplishments of my administration, I do not feel willing to accept its aid. So long as other big business corporations believed that the country's well-being could only be secured through the continuance in power of the Republican Party, however, he deemed their contributions entirely proper. Roosevelt's justification did not satisfy the editorial board of the New York Times. The fact that the chief beneficiary of the process is blind to its gross impropriety, declared the Times, and can see in it only a means to the promotion of the welfare of the nation dependent beyond question upon his attainment of the presidential office by election, shows how insidious and how irresistible has been the demoralization. The general unseemliness of large corporate contributions made little impact on the campaign, however, since it was widely known that corporations habitually contributed to both campaign funds. The scandal that did catch the public's attention and threatened to derail Roosevelt's campaign was the far more lethal accusation that the president and Cortelyou were engaged in a conspiracy to blackmail corporations. Judge Parker and fellow Democrats charged the Republicans with extortion, using detailed information on violations obtained from the newly created Bureau of Corporations, like a big stick with the threat of prosecution if a fat contribution to the Republican campaign was not made. Democratic newspapers insinuated that the prostitution of an entire federal department to the use of a campaign committee was cleverly planned and carefully executed. First, the papers accused, Roosevelt had appointed Cortelyou head of the cabinet department overseeing the new bureau. Then, having amassed the necessary information, Cortelyou was made chairman of the Republican National Committee. Roosevelt's advisers were divided over how to respond. Initially, Cortelyou and Garfield were reluctant to dignify the infamous accusation with a rejoinder. Taft disagreed. "I don't see why Cortelyou does not deny it, but he keeps mum," he wrote Nellie. Of course, Parker cites no evidence to sustain his charge, and Cortelyou's position is that until he does so, he is not called upon to answer. But I think it would be better to make a short denial. Roosevelt concurred with Taft that the charges must be refuted, but resolved, against all precedent, to answer them personally. "I am the man against whom Parker's assaults are really directed, and I am the man who can give the widest publicity to the denial," he told Cortelyou. "I should feel an intolerable humiliation if I were beaten because infamous charges had been made against me and good people regarded my silence as acquiescence in them." In characteristic fashion, Roosevelt drafted the statement himself, submitting it to his advisers for criticism. Revised speech in hand, he asked Garfield to take the midnight train to New York and confer with Cortelyou and Root. All reservations concerning the propriety of the president's personal involvement in the fray vanished when, in an inflammatory speech on November 3rd, 5 days before the election, Parker labeled Cortelyou's fund blood money. From the rear of his train in Meriden, Connecticut, Parker spoke without notes for the first time since the campaign began. The Democratic candidate, reporters suggested, was stirred from his usual reticence by the loud enthusiasm of the immense crowd of 5,000. His eyes flashed, his clenched hand swung above his head, and his voice rang out with a vigor that betrayed his emotion, as he declared that all other issues of the campaign were now subsumed by one great question: whether it is possible for interests in this country to control the elections with money. Parker scornfully claimed that when every trust in this country, including the Standard Oil Trust, is doing its best to elect the Republican ticket, it becomes the duty of the American people to determine once and for all whether money or manhood suffrage shall control. He described how Cortelyou had exploited his cabinet position to blackmail the trusts for campaign contributions. "This country," he pledged in closing, "shall not pass into the hands of the trusts." The crowd responded with a thundering cry that lasted until the train drew out of sight. At 10 o'clock the following night, Secretary Loeb summoned members of the press to the White House, where he handed them the president's signed statement. The direct and fierce tone of this letter became the common news of the hotels and streets in a few moments, prompting a flurry of discussion among politicians and the press. "The gravamen of these charges," Roosevelt began, "lies in the assertion that corporations have been blackmailed into contributing, and that in return they have been promised certain immunities or favors. Such accusations, leveled without any evidence, were monstrous," Roosevelt maintained. "If true, they would brand both of us forever with infamy. And inasmuch as they are false, heavy must be the condemnation of the man making them." He unequivocally dismissed the charge that Cortelyou had used intelligence gleaned from his cabinet position to coerce contributions a falsehood, and the insinuations that pledges were offered for contributions a wicked falsehood. All these allegations, Roosevelt flatly concluded, were unqualifiedly and atrociously false. In the wake of Roosevelt's vigorous and categorical rebuttal, Parker seemed to backpedal, claiming that he had made no criticism of the president, but had simply called attention to a notorious and offensive situation. Nor, in response to Roosevelt's direct challenge, did he offer to substantiate his earlier claims. "Parker fails to furnish proofs," headlines blared in response. The president's public rebuttal, Garfield happily observed, has knocked Parker flat. The outcome delighted Roosevelt. "Parker's attacks became so atrocious," an ebullient Roosevelt told Kermit, "that I determined, against the counsel of my advisers, to hit. And as I never believe in hitting soft, I hit him in a way he will remember. In spite of loud boasting, he made no real return attack at all, and I came out of the encounter with flying colors." As Election Day approached, Roosevelt's anxiety escalated. He confessed to his sister Corinne that he had never wanted anything in his life quite as much as the outward and visible sign of his country's approval. Elevated to the presidency as a result of a calamity to another rather than as the personal choice of the people, he longed to be chosen president on his own merits by the people of the United States. Should his campaign end in rejection, he consoled himself in moments fraught with tension that he had enjoyed a first-class run. And, if in defeat, he felt soured at not having had more instead of being thankful for having had so much, it would signal a small and mean mind. Late on the morning of November 8th, Roosevelt cast his vote in Oyster Bay. He had taken an overnight train to New York, where a crowd of home folk greeted him at the station with flags and banners. Arriving at the polling place, he sprang briskly from the carriage and ran up the stairs. As soon as his ballot was cast, he caught the 1:14 train back to Washington, reaching the White House at 6:30. Not expecting returns for several hours, Roosevelt tried not to think of the result, but to school himself to accept it as a man. He had scarcely crossed the threshold, however, when news arrived that he had carried doubtful New York with a plurality so large as to be astonishing. By the time he sat down with his family at dinner, sufficient returns had been received from key precincts in various states to suggest a tremendous drift in his direction. After dinner, the president joined a group of intimate friends and members of his official family in the Red Parlor to await further results. While Taft had not yet returned from voting in Cincinnati, Nellie and the wives of the other cabinet members were present. 11-year-old Archie, fairly plastered with badges, carried telegrams from the telegraph operator to his father, who read them aloud. At 9 p.m., a personal telegram arrived from Judge Parker conceding the election. "It was the greatest triumph I ever had had, or ever could have," Roosevelt wrote, "and I was very proud and happy." An hour later, Roosevelt greeted the Washington correspondents in the Executive Mansion office. Following an animated discussion, in which he made no attempt to conceal his gratification, the president leaned back in his chair and dictated a statement to his secretary. So quiet was everyone in the room, one correspondent noted, that one could hear the clock tick on the mantelshelf as he read his startling pronouncement. "I am deeply sensible of the honor done me by the American people in thus expressing their confidence in what I have done and have tried to do. I appreciate to the full the solemn responsibility this confidence imposed on me, and I shall do all that in my power lies not to forfeit it. On the 4th of March next, I shall have served 3 1/2 years, and the 3 1/2 years constitute my first term. The wise custom which limits the president to 2 terms regards the substance and not the form, and under no circumstance will I be a candidate for or accept another nomination. Roosevelt's statement was not an impulsive gesture made in a moment of delirious joy. He had considered renouncing a 3rd term weeks earlier, but decided to wait for the election results, lest it seem a bid for votes. From his first days in office, critics had disparaged Roosevelt's single-minded focus on his own advancement. Such negativity sharpened during the campaign as opponents charged that he would use the office of president to perpetuate himself in power. His simple pledge, in the wake of the Election Day triumph, silenced all such criticism. "I feel very strongly," Roosevelt explained to historian George Otto Trevelyan, "a public man's usefulness in the highest position becomes in the end impaired by the mere fact of too long continuance in that position. Even if custom had not frowned upon a 3rd term, he maintained, it would yet be true that in 1908 it would be better to have some man like Taft or Root succeed me in the presidency at the head of the Republican Party than to have me succeed myself. In all the essentials of policy, they look upon things as I do. But what they did and said would have a freshness which what I did and said could not possibly have, and they would be free from the animosities and suspicions which I had accumulated and would be able to take a new start." When all the votes were finally tallied, Roosevelt had achieved the greatest popular majority and the greatest electoral majority ever given to a candidate for president. He had won all the northern states, carried the western states previously claimed by Bryan, and added a totally unexpected coup in Missouri, breaking the Democratic Party's enduring hold on the South. "I am stunned by the overwhelming victory we have won," Roosevelt confessed. "I had no conception that such a thing was possible." "Everyone in the administration," Taft told his brother Charlie, "has had a smile that won't come off since the election." William Taft could well take particular satisfaction in his own vital contribution to the victorious campaign. Personal letters and newspaper articles recorded his tireless efforts and powerful speeches in defense of administration policy. The document that gave the most force to the Roosevelt campaign, journalist Murat Halstead told Taft, was your utterance on the Philippines on the stump. That had the air and the dignity and the conclusiveness of a decision handed down by the Supreme Court. Howard Hollister proudly noted that his old friend had generated thousands of votes by standing fearlessly on the issues, making a contribution much greater, probably, than you would be willing to admit. Characteristically, Taft refused to take credit, replying to all who congratulated him that the victory is so overwhelming that I cannot think that anything that was done in the way of speaking had any particular effect. Above all, he insisted, the success was a tribute to the personal popularity of the president. Notwithstanding the general elation surrounding the historic election, Taft issued a public warning to the Republican Party. "It is no unheard-of thing to have a majority as large and sweeping as this, followed by a defeat equally emphatic at the next presidential election. Without a candidate as compelling and charismatic as Roosevelt, it was very possible that the country would have voted Democratic. The Republican Party must not diminish in any way the care with which the public interests must be protected." His timely admonition met with widespread approval. "Unless the Republican Party is wise and liberal toward all legitimate and right demands of the people in the social and economic controversies which are going on," one respondent agreed, "we must expect sweeping radical victories during the next few years." For those who hope to see a more progressive Republican Party, Roosevelt's surprise decision to forego a 3rd term seemed pregnant with promise of a vigorous future for reform. Now that he was absolutely independent of all party bosses and party machines, the Minneapolis Journal predicted, Theodore Roosevelt is likely to make the administration of 1905-9 one of the 2 or 3 most resplendent and beneficial in the history of the Republic. The St. Paul Globe endorsed this sanguine assessment, proclaiming that if Roosevelt stayed true to the best that is in him, he could become one of the great presidents in our history. Even his harshest critics had nothing but praise for Roosevelt's declaration. "It was to his everlasting honor," the Sun proclaimed, "that in the hour of his triumph, the president chose to make his second term his last." Though he reveled in the acclaim that accompanied his declaration, Theodore Roosevelt would come to bitterly regret his action, reportedly telling a friend that if he could rescind the pledge, he would willingly cut off his hand at the wrist. Chapter 16. Sitting on the Lid. After weeks of cloudy skies and heavy snow, the morning of March 4, 1905, broke blue, flecked with lazily floating white clouds, the day Theodore Roosevelt was inaugurated president in his own right. Washingtonians happily remarked that, once again, Roosevelt luck had brought Roosevelt weather. For the tens of thousands lining the streets to watch the president's carriage pass from the White House to the Capitol, the morning sun gave brilliancy and luster to the fluttering mass of flags and banners. Roosevelt appeared supremely happy, waving and bowing as a record-breaking crowd hailed him with the roar of the ocean upon a rock-bound coast. The galleries were filled inside the Senate chamber, where Charles Fairbanks readied to take the vice presidential oath. Raucous cheers broke out when Roosevelt arrived. Stepping onto the floor, he at once scanned the gallery for Edith and the children. Spotting them, he did not wave, furtively nor half-heartedly, nor as if he were afraid someone might see this evidence of his domestic affection, but with demonstration frank and full. His demeanor proclaimed simply, "This, my dear wife and children, is the proudest moment of our lives." Hundreds of spectators perched in trees, crowded on rooftops, and lined the wings of the Capitol building as the president stood before the vast multitude and delivered a friendly little homily on the duties of the nation and citizen, betraying nothing of the truculent note that often marked his speeches. "Much has been given us, and much will rightfully be expected from us," he told the crowd. "We have become a great nation, forced by the fact of its greatness into relations with the other nations of the earth. Our relations with the other powers of the world are important, but still more important are our relations among ourselves." The Industrial Revolution, Roosevelt maintained, had generated both marvelous well-being and the care and anxiety inseparable from the accumulation of great wealth, creating a host of problems that government had the responsibility to address. He spoke with characteristic earnestness, one reporter wrote, stressing every word with such force that it seemed as if he would like to get hold of each individual person in his audience and pound home the truths which he believes he is uttering, till the wretched man should be forced to admit the error of his ways and agree with the speaker. Editorialists predicted tempestuous doings now that Roosevelt was president in his own right rather than by the happenstance of assassination. Backed by a massive popular mandate, he would no longer be held in check by the conservative bloc in Congress. "The Republican Party has turned the corner and is now on a new road," William Allen White proclaimed. "It is hard to believe that the party that 8 years ago was advocating the policy of hands-off is now ready to lay hands on capital, and such rough hands, too, when capital goes wrong. The old order changeth, yielding place to the new." Turbulent events would indeed follow. But first, the newly elected president embarked on a 2-month vacation trip through the Southwest and the Rocky Mountain region. A Rough Riders reunion in Texas began the hiatus, followed by a 5-day wolf hunting expedition in Oklahoma and a 3-week bear hunt in Colorado. "Everybody rejoices that he is to have some time for recuperation," an Ohio newspaper editorialized. "Only the bears and the mountain lions have occasion for regret." On the morning of April 4th, cheered by well-wishers at the Pennsylvania Railroad Station, Roosevelt stepped onto a handsomely fitted train consisting of a private car, a Pullman sleeper, and a buffet car. He looked, one reporter noted, like a small boy let out of school, rejoicing that he would soon enter wild country beyond the reach of official duties and office seekers. Along the route, Roosevelt followed his customary procedure, emerging onto the platform at every stop to shake hands and deliver brief remarks. It was much more pleasant than ordinarily, he told his son Kermit, because the presidential race was over and he was finally free from the everlasting suspicion a candidate invariably arouses. Even in the traditionally Democratic strongholds of Louisville, Austin, and Dallas, flags waved, cannons thundered, and tens of thousands greeted him with wild enthusiasm. Clearly, these hunting expeditions not only afforded Roosevelt a most genuine pleasure, but provided the opportunity for revitalization. In Oklahoma, he was in the saddle 8 or 9 hours every day, helping to track and kill 11 wolves. It was tremendous galloping over cut banks, prairie dog towns, flats, creek bottoms, everything, he exulted. One run was 9 miles long, and I was the only man in at the finish, except the professional wolf hunter. In Colorado, he was up at daybreak and refused to stop until the sun set, keeping his little band of huntsmen in constant motion. As always, Roosevelt found the intense physical trial invigorating. While his face was roughened by wind and sun and snow, he felt healthier than he had for months. Reporters questioned how any pressing matters arising in his absence would be handled. "Oh, things will be all right," he emphatically responded. "I have left Taft sitting on the lid." The vivid phrase instantly inspired cartoons and commentary. One widely reprinted caricature depicted Taft wielding a big stick while seated on the lid of a boiling cauldron. Even his impressive bulk appears scarcely able to stem the grave and exacting problems of the highest interest, Panama, Santo Domingo, Venezuela, and Morocco, threatening to burst forth. In another cartoon, an outsized Taft spans 3 chairs. He is firmly planted on the widest, the chair of the president, but his legs extend on either side, occupying both the chair of the Secretary of State and the chair of the Secretary of War. In the absence of both President Roosevelt and Secretary of State John Hay, who was on a long cruise attempting to recover his health, official Washington considered Taft acting president and the real head of all executive departments. Little mention was made in the press of sitting Vice President Charles A. Fairbanks, as the press focused all attention on Taft. Reporters noted the unusual sight of foreign diplomats going to the War Department instead of to the State Department to conduct business. Such a proliferation of responsibilities might well have intimidated a weaker man, an Ohio paper commented. But William Howard Taft is a very large man, mentally and physically. Panama soon emerged as the most pressing of the trouble spots threatening to boil over. Taft had been 8,000 miles away in November of 1903 when Roosevelt sent U.S. ships to support a Panamanian uprising against Colombia. Recognition was swiftly granted to the newly formed Republic of Panama, and a treaty was negotiated that guaranteed Panamanian independence. In return, the United States was allowed to purchase land to build a canal. "I took the canal zone," Roosevelt later boasted. When word first arrived at the McClure's office that Roosevelt had snitched Panama, Viola Roseborough remembered that there were gasps, accompanied by amusement and excitement. Ida Tarbell, however, was very grave. Tarbell considered the president's seizure of the canal zone a dishonorable outrage. According to Roseborough, Ida got a line on Teddy that she never lost sight of. While she considered him a delight and a wonderful person and of great value to the country, Tarbell could not overlook the despotic side of Roosevelt's leadership. "You cannot conceive of Lincoln's trifling with his conscience," she had admonished, "even for the sake of an international canal." Taft had likewise been absent during the fierce senatorial debate surrounding the treaty that granted the United States permanent rights to a 10-mile strip in exchange for $10 million and a significant annual payment. Assuming responsibility for overseeing the commission shortly after his return, however, Taft proved a quick study. "He had an enormous capacity for mastering official detail," one historian observed, content that the overall direction came from his superior. Under Taft's command, the commission was authorized to establish official guidelines for the canal zone, make all engineering, construction, and sanitary contracts, acquire private lands, tabulate all money spent, and institute a civil service system. This complex supervisory job was really enough to occupy the whole time of any average executive, Taft's biographer maintains, yet it was just one among the many tasks that fell to Secretary Taft during these crowded years. As construction of the canal got underway in the fall of 1904, a wave of popular discontent swept through Panama. Panamanians began to suspect that the United States intended to establish an independent colony within their country, compromising their own sovereignty and economic well-being. A small band of soldiers threatened to seize power. Endeavoring to diffuse tensions, Roosevelt dispatched Taft to the Isthmus. Conscious of the need to project goodwill and friendship, Taft asked Nellie to accompany him. Their arrival in Colon, Nellie recalled, felt like coming home. The whole atmosphere and surroundings, the people, the language they spoke, the houses and streets, the rank earth odors, and the very feel of the air reminded me so strongly of the Philippines as to give me immediately a delightful sense of friendly familiarity with everything and everybody, she later wrote. They remained in Panama for 2 weeks. During the days, Taft held private conferences with Panamanian officials. In the evenings, he and Nellie socialized at receptions, dinners, and balls. As in the Philippines, Taft charmed the local citizens with his surprising skill on the dance floor. Finally, an agreement was forged that encompassed a range of political and economic issues. The Panamanian citizens greeted the published text with delight. As small boys hawking newspapers shouted extras from every street corner, Nellie recalled, excited groups stood about here and there wreathed in smiles and talking with great animation. Everybody seemed wholly satisfied, and wherever we went, we were met with cheers and cries of Viva! A number of problems regarding canal construction required attention, however, before Roosevelt returned from his hunting trip. A serious dispute had arisen between John Wallace, the chief engineer, and William Gorgas, the chief sanitary officer. Wallace remained highly skeptical of his colleague's work to contain the spread of mosquitoes on the theory that the insect transmitted yellow fever. Castigating Gorgas' idea as merely experimental, Wallace failed to carry out safety protocols that recommended mosquito-proof screens in all government offices. When a virulent outbreak of yellow fever sent a majority of American workers retreating back to the States, Gorgas demanded greater independent authority from both Wallace and the Commission. Here again, I must trust your judgment, Roosevelt wrote to Taft from Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Taft wisely threw his support to Gorgas and eventually called for Wallace to resign. With equal insight and acumen, Taft resolved conflicts in Santo Domingo that threatened U.S. interests in Morocco and Venezuela. You are handling everything just right, Roosevelt praised him on April 8th. 2 weeks later, Roosevelt again assured Taft that he was keeping the lid on in great shape. Each letter expressed unconditional confidence and support. You are on the ground, he reiterated. You see the needs of the situation, and I shall back up whatever you do. Invariably, Roosevelt's letters reflect profound respect and gratitude for his friend's service. I wish you knew Taft, whom I have had acting as Secretary of State as well as Secretary of War in Hayes' absence, he told historian George Trevelyan. To strength and courage, clear insight, and practical common sense, he adds a very noble and disinterested character. I know you would like him. He helps me in every way more than I can say. And John Hay, Roosevelt confided, Taft, by the way, is doing excellently, as I knew he would, and is the greatest comfort to me. Roosevelt finally returned to Washington on May 12th. 6 weeks later, Taft left for a journey of his own, a three-month cruise to the Philippines and the Far East. Recalling his pledge that the Filipino people would always remain first in his heart, Taft had been troubled by reports from Dr. Pardo de Tavera, one of the three Filipino members of the commission. When Taft had departed 2 years earlier, Tavera wrote, everything was in good order, and every Filipino was confident in the future. But the commission had since lost its pole star, the policy of working together with the Filipino people to shape their destiny. Under Luke Wright, Taft's successor, discontent was general, resentment profound and well-founded. Tavera implored Taft to return to the islands for a visit. The Filipino people regarded the former governor general as the only man who can and will re-establish justice and liberty here. Convinced that he must return to assess the situation in person, Taft assembled a party of 80 people to accompany him, including 7 senators, 23 congressmen, and a dozen journalists. His guest list was inclusive and bipartisan, embracing Democrats and Republicans, pro-tariff reduction men and stand-patters, strong supporters of the administration's policy and fierce opponents alike. He hoped that first-hand experience of the island's rich potential and personal encounters with the Filipino people would beget a more supportive attitude toward legislation to reduce tariffs, build railroads, and improve agricultural development. "I doubt if so formidable a congressional representation ever went so far," he proudly noted. Not long after Taft's party embarked for Southeast Asia, Secretary of State John Hay lost his long battle with illness. "Just heard sad news," Taft cabled Roosevelt, wondering if he should postpone his journey and return to Washington. "If it were not that I feel so keenly the great importance of having you in the Philippines," Roosevelt replied, "I should have been tempted to keep you over here, for I miss you greatly." He informed Taft that he would likely ask Elihu Root to take Hay's place, although he confided to Lodge that he hesitated a little between Root and Taft, noting that Taft was very close to him. The prospect of having both men by his side left no room for doubt. Taft dispelled any qualms Roosevelt might have felt, urging the president to appoint Root to the premier post. "My dear fellow," Roosevelt replied, "I could say nothing higher of you than that it was just exactly characteristic of you. I do not believe that you will ever quite understand what strength and comfort and help you are to me." Under the sway of Taft's amicable leadership, everyone who had joined the expedition got along surprisingly well. "I do not think that I have ever known anyone with the equanimity, amiability, and kindliness of Mr. Taft," Alice Roosevelt reported. "During all that summer, I never once saw him really cross or upset. He was always beaming, genial, and friendly through all his official duties and the task of keeping harmony among his varied and somewhat temperamental army of trippers." In the evenings, guests enjoyed formal dances, sleight-of-hand performances, mock trials, and pillow fights. "The party has been a very jolly one," Taft related to Roosevelt, "and Democrats and Republicans have joined alike in praising the fine weather and really delightful voyage." Friends and family had warned Taft that dealing with Alice, or Princess Alice, as she had been dubbed by the press, would prove challenging. Despite such admonitions, he found her unspoiled and delightfully forthright. "She's quite amenable to suggestion, and I've seen nothing about the girl to indicate conceit or a swelled head," he told Nellie, who had elected to spend a quiet summer in England with the children following their hectic year. "At times she could be oblivious to the comforts of other people," he explained, "but considering what she has gone through and who she is, the young woman managed to make herself extremely popular with the entire party." Nevertheless, he remained troubled by Alice's flamboyant flirtation with Nicholas Longworth, a worldly 35-year-old congressman from Cincinnati with a reputation for numerous dalliances. Taft was aware that Alice and Nick had been seeing one another prior to the cruise. He had heard stories about the fast set to which they belonged. "She seems to be so much taken up with Nick," Taft reported to Nellie, "that she pays little attention to anybody else. They took meals together, sat side by side on deck, and partnered on the dance floor, where Alice reportedly looked almost unreal in her clinging gown, which matched the sea. As she glided through the dance, her long, spangled scarf wound itself around her, serpent-like." Noting that the young couple appeared to revel in conversations usually confined to husband and wife, Taft finally confronted Alice. "I think I ought to know if you are engaged to Nick," he suggested in a gently paternal manner. Alice cryptically replied, More or less, Mr. Secretary, more or less. The arrival of the Taft Party in Manila on August 4th inspired widespread celebration. Guns boomed and thousands filled the streets as the official delegation progressed to the Malacañang Palace for the welcoming ceremony. From the outset, Taft was determined to remedy the growing animosity between the Filipino people and the current insular government. The policy of the Roosevelt administration, he reiterated at every stop, was the Philippines for the Filipinos. If the American officials were not in sympathy with this policy, he assured the islanders, they would be recalled. While he continued to believe the Filipinos needed to prepare for independence, Taft officially announced that the long-anticipated popular assembly would be established in April of 1907. The Filipino people, the New York Tribune reported, greeted this definitive proclamation with great enthusiasm. Informed that the colonial administration considered Filipino families not of sufficient rank to entertain senators and congressmen, Taft decided he and Alice would move immediately from the palace to the home of Benito Legarda. "I knew no way but the direct way," he explained, "to show that we had no sympathy with the apparent desire to exclude Filipino hosts from those who should entertain the party." At a very handsome ball hosted by the Legardas, Taft and Alice delighted the Filipinos by joining in the native Rigodon square dance. Taft had taken care to practice the complex steps with Alice and several other young ladies during the long ocean voyage. A number of similar receptions in the homes of local citizens went a long way in cementing friendships. Lodging with the Legardas also allowed Taft to meet with scores of disaffected Filipinos who would never have visited him at the palace with Governor General Wright present. All day long, one observer recorded, the great hall was occupied, the men sitting by a long way in cementing friendships. Lodging with the Legardas also allowed Taft to meet with scores of disaffected Filipinos who would never have visited him at the palace with Governor General Wright present. All day long, one observer recorded, the great hall was occupied, the men sitting by the open windows disposing of one long cigar after another. Hearing their grievances, Taft reluctantly concluded that the majority of the commission, including the Governor General, were utterly lacking in the proper spirit regarding the native population. "They seem to think it does not make much difference whether they have the support of the Filipinos or not," he lamented. "To me, it makes every difference in the success of the government." Indeed, he wrote to Nellie, many Filipinos insisted that if only the Tafts returned to Manila, they would soon restore the old condition of things. The current situation was dispiriting, for it necessitated the removal of the Governor General and possibly two other commission members whom he considered friends. Taft and his entourage made the round of the archipelago, traveling by small boats, bamboo rafts, carriages, and horseback. They surveyed agricultural conditions where sugar, hemp, and rice were grown, meeting with tradesmen, government officials, educators, manufacturers, and farmers. Correspondents who accompanied the party noted a happy sea change in the attitudes of several protectionist congressmen, particularly Sereno Payne, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and General Charles Grosvenor of Ohio. "It is already apparent," the Tribune editorialized, "that Secretary Taft's plan of enlarging the political and mental horizons of leading men of both parties as respects Philippine questions is working out admirably." Several legislators personally expressed their amazement and gratitude to Taft. "It was a great trip and cannot be otherwise than helpful to the government," one member told him. "I never realized until this journey the magnitude of the Philippine problem. Nor did I realize your devotion to the cause. I've heard a great many speeches made in my time, but never heard a series of better ones than were made by you while touring the islands. It is a miracle that so large a party was so harmonious, and the credit is due to your example." While Taft's primary mission was to the Philippines, the expedition also made stops in China and Japan, where Taft secretly met with Japan's Prime Minister, Taro Katsura. Undisclosed for the next 20 years, this meeting would have lasting consequences for the region. Long-standing hostilities between Russia and Japan had flared into war over competing territorial interests in Korea and China. Roosevelt had closely followed the evolution of this conflict, hoping he might mediate between the two warring powers. From the start, he had sympathized with Japan's desire to oversee affairs in Korea, keep a strong hold on Port Arthur, and return Manchuria to China. Still, he recognized that mounting Japanese victories would expand the imperial government's demands, upsetting the balance of power in the Far East. He was delighted, therefore, when Taft contacted him in late April to affirm that the Japanese were interested in having the U.S. president facilitate peace talks. In fact, Roosevelt was so enthusiastic that he curtailed his hunting expedition a week to commence dialogue with the Japanese and Russian ministers. Concealing the fact that the Japanese had initiated the process, Roosevelt sent identical letters to both sides. He requested that they open direct negotiations for peace, offering his services in arranging preliminaries as to time and place of meeting. When both the belligerents agreed, Roosevelt received accolades. It is recognized all the world over as another triumph of Roosevelt the man, the New York Tribune editorialized. It was America alone that assumed the responsibility. It is to America alone that the world will give the credit. As preparations for a peace conference in Portsmouth, New Hampshire began, Taft sailed into Yokohama, Japan, where his party received a demonstrative welcome. Fireworks heralded the arrival of the ship, and thousands of citizens lined gaily decorated streets. From the harbor city, Taft journeyed to Tokyo for his confidential talk with Count Katsura. Taft assured Katsura that while he did not officially speak for the president, he was certain of Roosevelt's position. Katsura made it clear that, Korea being the direct cause of our war with Russia, it was of absolute importance that after the war, Japan should control Korea to the extent of requiring that Korea enter into no foreign treaties without the consent of Japan. In return, Taft sought assurance that Japan did not harbor any aggressive designs whatever on the Philippines. Having reached agreement on both points, Taft informed Katsura that without the Senate's consent, the president could not enter into a formal alliance or even a confidential informal agreement. Nevertheless, he expressed certainty that the two countries were in such fundamental accord on the issues discussed that the conversation could be treated as if a treaty had been signed. Taft promptly telegraphed a memo of the entire exchange to the president. "If I have spoken too freely or inaccurately or unwittingly," he concluded, "I know you can or will correct it." Roosevelt immediately dismissed his concerns, replying, "Your conversation with Count Katsura absolutely correct in every respect. Wish you would state to Katsura that I confirm every word you have said." On August 5th, accompanied by the sound of booming guns, the peace envoys from Russia and Japan met with the president aboard the Mayflower, anchored in Oyster Bay. After a buffet lunch, served with cold white wine, the envoys proceeded to the U.S. Naval Base at Portsmouth. In the days that followed, agreements on Korea, Port Arthur, and Manchuria were reached with relative ease. Japan's insistence on some form of compensation from Russia, however, threatened to torpedo the conference. The Russian envoys took the position that Russia had neither been conquered nor could be considered prostrate in the enemy's hands. Therefore, they argued, Japan had no right to extract an indemnity. Increasingly frustrated with mediating the dispute, Roosevelt confided to Kermit, "I am having my hair turned gray by dealing with the Russian and Japanese negotiators." In the end, Roosevelt persuaded Japan that prolonging the war simply to secure money would lose international support. A peace treaty was finally signed on September 5, 1905, earning Roosevelt praise at home and abroad, as well as the Nobel Peace Prize. Despite such international triumphs, pressing and complex domestic issues threatened the solidarity of the Republican Party. Once again, Taft had barely returned when he was recruited to suture the wound. Taft's three-month odyssey ended at 3:27 p.m. on October 2, 1905, when he stepped onto the platform at Union Station, appearing hearty and vigorous as he greeted colleagues with a big smile and a warm handshake. That evening, he dined with the President and First Lady, along with Root, Garfield, and a few family friends. "We had a most interesting dinner," Garfield told his wife.